Welcome back to Stack Trace, your weekly podcast about Apple, tech, programming, and lots of other things in between and outside and below and above and everywhere. With me, John Sandell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
Hi, John. I'm doing great here.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm doing pretty great as well. It's been a really busy week for me. Like, it tends to be like this almost every year for me leading up to the holidays. I have so many things that I want to finish, and I want to be able to like go on a little bit of a holiday break and feel like I don't have a lot of things left that I wish I would have finished. I want to kind of get everything done and then be able to relax. So these last couple of weeks have been really, really busy, and it almost always is like that for me.
Yeah, gotta get those New Year resolutions done, right? Before the end of the year.
Right, exactly. Before I make new ones. Yeah, it was literally like that last year, as maybe some of our listeners will remember, that I released Publish on like the day before New Year's Eve, I believe. And yes. Because I had promised to do it during the last year. I don't have any of those left, thankfully. So I don't think I'll be working on the day before New Year's Eve this year, but who knows? Maybe something will pop up.
Yeah, I remember, I think, chatting with you from like the New Year's Eve family reunion. I was like texting you about Publish or something.
Yeah, and I think I was asking you to like clone it and install it and, you know, test the CLI and things like that to make sure everything was working, not on my machine. So yeah, that was fun times.
Definitely.
So what have you been up to lately?
So I've just shipped AirBuddy 2.2 yesterday.
Oh, wow.
As we are recording. Yeah.
That's great. Iterating quickly.
Yeah, definitely. And this lines up with what we talked about when I was working on the 2.0, which is there's always the next update, right?
So exactly.
It's not that big a deal if something's missing from the initial release. I mean, if it's the first release of an app, then of course you have to really pick what you want to ship with your 1.0, but when it's already an update to an existing app, there's always the next one. And I've been doing that. I've been slowly shipping features that I wish I had shipped with the 2.0, and also fixing lots of bugs and improving lots of things. But there's one thing in particular with this release that I think is an interesting point of discussion here. And it's that this new version introduces support for transparency mode when running on macOS Mojave. So AirBuddy supports macOS Mojave and up. So it will run on Mojave, Catalina, and of course Big Sur. But there are some headsets from Apple which the headset itself requires a newer version of macOS in order to have all of the features. And one such feature is transparency mode, which is in the Beats Solo Pro, also the AirPods Max and the AirPods Pro. So transparency mode requires 10.15.1. So basically Catalina and up, but I was able to make it work in Mojave.
That's very cool. So what does that mean for it to only work on a certain operating system version and above? I mean, I understand what it means, you know, from the user's point of view, but how come it doesn't work technically? Like, is there some support libraries or something that are not there in order to enable that feature? Or is it just that it wasn't included, so they just made that the cut-off version just to make it simpler for them, like technically? Or what was the underlying reason?
Yeah, so it doesn't mean that like if you have your AirPods Pro connected to a machine that's not running 10.15.1, you can't use transparency mode. Of course, you can. You can press and hold on the AirPods Pro and it will engage transparency mode. But what it means is that the OS itself is not aware of transparency mode. So it doesn't know that transparency mode is a thing. So there's no UI anywhere for you to enable transparency mode from the computer. So the only way to do that is through the controls on the headset itself. In the case of AirBuddy, it also affects AirBuddy because AirBuddy relies on the operating system to do the Bluetooth stack stuff. So it meant that in AirBuddy, you also could not engage transparency mode. And AirBuddy has this feature which I use all the time when I have my AirPods Pro connected to my Mac, which lets you toggle between modes using a global keyboard shortcut. So if you had that in Mojave, it wouldn't work properly with AirPods Pro because it had no way to know that the AirPods Pro supports transparency mode.
Right.
Because that support is just not in the system libraries that everybody relies on. But turns out those system libraries, all they do is they talk to the device to ask the device, hey, what do you support? And that's usually when you're in Bluetooth land, it's like bit sets. So the device will return a bit set of representing the features that it supports. And one of those bits is, does this support transparency mode? So through some spelunking, I was able to figure out what the bit is and where I can get it from, and basically backport transparency mode to AirBuddy when running in OSs before 10.15.1.
That's very cool. So through that technique, when you're kind of pinging the device or the headphones, you can get that bit mask or that bit set, and you can then get that information. But how do you then actually set it? Like, you also need to have some kind of endpoint for sending, like a toggle that this should be on or off.
Yeah, so that's also quite easy. It's actually easier than doing the check, because the way it works is the current listening mode is represented by a number. So it's, of course, in the high-level code, it's an enum, but in the end, it's just a number, basically. And all that I had to do was figure out what the number is. That means transparency mode. And then I can set it on the device and it will respect that.
Ah, cool. So how do you typically arrive at that number? Do you do some spelunking just like you did for the like receiving end, just for reading that value? Or do you just like try a bunch of different numbers and see what works?
Well, the trial and error part would be a thing that would work, of course. In this case, it's quite easy because it's basically 0, 1, 2, 3. So
you can guess what the next number is.
Yeah, exactly. So 0 is unknown. 1 is normal, so no active noise cancellation. 2 is active noise cancellation, and 3 is transparency mode. So, well, transparency mode was the last one that was introduced, so I guess that one is 3. So that one was quite easy to guess. But I actually did that by querying the device for its current listening mode. So I would put them in transparency mode, then like print out the property that says which listening mode it's actually using, and it will return 3. And then I did the same for the other, just to confirm that I wasn't like guessing the wrong number. But yeah, that one was actually quite easy. It was actually figuring out how to query the device for support that was the tricky part, because I didn't want the user to like say they have a headset connected and it does not support transparency mode. Then it would be toggling between noise cancellation and this unknown mode that the device doesn't support. That wouldn't be a good idea.
Right, exactly. So when you're performing this kind of networking, this is, of course, very different from like querying a REST API, right? Like, I guess sometimes during the development of AirBuddy, you wish that if only the AirPods would have a REST API where I could just say like, you know, / listening mode / set and just like make a post request to that and you're done with some JSON.
Yeah.
So how does the device like differentiate between having like audio stream to it and having these commands sent to it? Like, I guess you also had to figure out what kind of packages you can send over the Bluetooth wire, so to speak, the invisible Bluetooth wire, in order to like command them to do these kind of things?
Yeah, so fortunately, I don't have to go down to that level. The system, so the Bluetooth daemon on the Mac, and of course the Bluetooth drivers and everything, they will handle that low-level packet transferring and things like that. So by the time it arrives at an application, which is using something like Core Bluetooth or IO Bluetooth on the Mac, It's already represented as nice properties on an object, so it's a lot easier than that. You could go down to that level if you wanted to, but then it would be, yeah, a lot more complicated, I think. But in terms of how it works, Bluetooth has lots of different specs and lots of different specs that can be active at the same time. So there are multiple profiles, and there's Bluetooth Classic and Bluetooth Low Energy, which are different beasts, and they can kind of work in parallel to an extent. So I'm very glad that I don't actually have to go down to that level, because it would be a lot more difficult. So basically, when I am reading these values or setting them, of course, when I set the value, it is basically an asynchronous call, because I don't know when that command is going to arrive at the headset side of things. But when I'm getting the value, it's already cached. So it's basically, you can think of it as an offline first approach.
Right.
Kind of like you download the data from the server and then you cache it. Fortunately, the Bluetooth daemon does that for me on macOS, so I don't have to do that myself. And there are also mechanisms for you to get notified when it changes. So if the user changes from transparency mode to noise cancellation, for instance, manually using the controls on the headset, I can get notified about that. So when it comes time to toggle, I can toggle to the right thing. And this actually had quite a few bugs in the previous implementation. And as part of doing this whole thing in Mojave, I actually did a pretty significant overhaul of how listening modes are handled in RBuddy, and it made the whole experience a lot better.
Very cool. So it sounds like handling raw Bluetooth on Apple's platforms, I mean, not raw in the sense of sending the actual packets yourself, but using these system APIs, it's not as low level as one might think. Like, if you get those nice object representations from the API, then, you know, it sounds like it's a little bit more high level than what I might have expected.
Yeah, definitely. I wouldn't call them nice objects, though. The objects can be quite nasty. There's all sorts of weirdness, because you're dealing with such a lossy transmission method. So Bluetooth is quite lossy. It's not like a nice little TCP socket that will retry and do all sorts of error correction and things like that. It is quite rough. So there are lots of little tricks that you have to do to like retry things when they fail. And many times, like one example is when I'm trying to actually connect to a headset, which has also been improved in the new version, I cannot wait for the timeout that the system will give me, because that's way too long. And I know that if the connection doesn't complete in like 5 seconds, it will not complete, and it will time out after like 30 seconds, and the user will not wait 30 seconds for a connection to complete. So I have to do the classic like back off retry thing. I think that's what we call it, right? When you retry after a certain limit, and if it fails again, you increase the delay between the current retry and the next one.
Yeah.
And you go through that progression until you just give up. Fortunately, it's very rare they will come to the point where it gives up. Most of the time, if it fails the first attempt, the second one works. But if I were to wait for the standard timeout, which I don't know if it's 30 seconds, it's way too long, basically. And there's no way that I could see to customize it. So yeah, there are little things like that you have to think about.
Right. That technique that you mentioned there, like exponential back off, basically, right? Like when you're like retrying, but with an exponentially increasing timeout. Mm-hmm. That's something that I wish more apps in general would do, because what you see so much in, especially on iOS, for example, like iOS apps, they will perform some kind of network call. And if it fails, like even if you're offline or something, it will just say an error occurred. And then you have like a retry button, or you pull to refresh, and then you have to like manually try. And the other thing that some apps do is that they just retry automatically all the time, right? Without like that timeout increasing exponentially. And that's such a great technique because it kind of strikes a nice balance between those two extremes, like having either the user manually have to retry the operation and like just keep retrying constantly, which might just keep failing if the server is down or if the user is indeed offline or something like that, right? So that's something that is not so tricky to implement. I mean, of course, there are so many things in the details there, but if you're using something like Combine or even just like URL session or something, implementing something like that is not so difficult, where you can keep a timer and you can have like that timeout. You can retry the request if it failed. You can, of course, check the status code to maybe make some decisions based on what kind of error that it was. So if you got like a 500 error from the server like three times after trying, maybe you should stop trying so you're not DDoSing your own server, right? Yeah. But doing that exponential kind of increase there where you start maybe with like a 2 second retry and then you go to like 4 seconds, then you go to 16 seconds and so on. Like you increase it exponentially all the time. Like that's a really good technique to keep in mind, I think.
Yeah, definitely. The way I do it generally, and I think it's the way I've done it this time as well, is as soon as I say start connecting, I make the connect call, I schedule a dispatch work item for the initial timeout. And then as soon as I get a response, if it's successful, I then cancel that dispatch block so it won't run. And I think work items in libdispatch are a great way to do that. It's even better in Swift. In this case, this particular code is all Objective-C, but especially in Swift, like it's really nice to use dispatch work items to do this sort of stuff.
Yeah, I feel like dispatch work item is one of those like kind of underutilized types in dispatch where like you can use it the exact same way as when you're just submitting a closure or a block onto a dispatch queue, but now you get a reference to this item, which you can then cancel. So it's so useful, for example, to implement debouncing, where if you want to only perform like a search, if you have like a search as you type kind of functionality, and you only want to kick off that actual search request once the user hasn't typed for like, you know, 200 milliseconds or something, you can do the same thing. Like on every keystroke, you schedule that work item, but then you cancel it if a new keystroke comes in. But then if 200 milliseconds passed and the work item starts, then you actually do the network request. Then here you can kind of do sort of the reverse of that, right? Where you set up a work item that you're kind of expecting to cancel if the request is successful, but then you keep it around as a backup if you need to retry. So yeah, I think there's so many really nice APIs in Grand Central Dispatch in general, and this is definitely one of them.
Yeah, I also use it to implement a coalescer, which coalesces things. Which is something I have to do a lot in AirBuddy. And it's also useful when you're doing things such as syncing. I've actually written this for Chibi Studio, I think, where if you do lots of changes to your local library, you will enqueue a change request to CloudKit. But I run it through this coalescer, which basically, like, if you call it 50 times within 1 second, it will wait and accumulate those changes and then submit just one sync call in the end. And I also do that in AirBuddy. So yeah, it's basically like a collection of things that takes into account a timeout, basically. I think we're entering into Combine and then reactive programming territory, but
yeah, absolutely. I was going to say that it sounds like you're building your own Combine.
Yeah, but it's just this one thing, so it's a very basic thing that I needed, so I made it for myself. But I also want to hear from you because you have just shipped a new version of Swift by Sandel, which we've been talking about here for a few weeks, and I've now had the chance to experience it, and I think it's great. So I'd love to know more. What's the deal with Swift by Sandel 3.0?
Yeah, so as we record, I just shipped it a few hours ago, actually. So it's brand new. It's a new version of my website. And like you mentioned, we've been talking about it for a few weeks, and I've been working on it for really long time, actually. Like I first started prototyping what would eventually become the new start page, which is the main new feature in this new version, many, many months ago. And I've talked a little bit about this on the show, how I had some difficulties like deciding exactly what I wanted the start page to be like. And in the beginning, I had, I guess, more ambitious ideas for it. Like, I wanted to make it more like a this very advanced, like, grid of articles that, you know, was a big feed and you could read two articles side by side or something. But then I realized that simple is probably better in this case, not only in terms of the code required to write it or, like, the maintenance of it, but also in terms of the user experience. Like, I don't think many people want to read, like, two articles at the same time.
One with each eye, right?
Right. So I ended up with a simpler design, but it was then also difficult to decide, like, what to actually include on the start page, because it's easy to say, okay, I want to keep things simple, but that's often harder than doing it more complex, because you have to cut out things. You have to decide what should actually be here. So I ended up with this kind of feed-like design where the main difference between the 2.0 era of Swift by Sundell, which was released in September 2019, so it's been running for like a little bit more than a year, and this new version now, is that the previous start page, it had these different sections, and within each section, I would show the latest two like weekly articles, the latest two podcasts, and then I would have like a browse all link. But now instead, I'm combining all of the different content that I have, whether it's podcasts or articles or tips or Q&A and basics and all the other things that I do into one feed. And that's what you see on the start page. You immediately, when you open up the website, you can start reading the latest articles. And that was really kind of the core goal that I realized I want to achieve, is that instead of opening up the start page and then having to decide what you want to click on in order to read something, I just wanted you to be able to open up the website and just start reading. Because you might be waiting for Xcode to compile, right? You might just want to, I don't know, like read something for 20 minutes or something, or you might just have a little bit more time and you want to read a number of different articles. I think this design works really well for that, because regardless if you just want to browse something quickly or you want to read many different things, you can do that with this new feed design. You can start scrolling and read the latest things. And then when you reach more towards the end, then I decided to, instead of just keeping adding articles, because the articles are rendered at full length, so you can see the entire article on the start page now and just read the whole thing. But then when you start reaching the end of the feed, I realized that now if you've come so far that you've read like 10 articles in a row or something, or you've just scrolled down, then it doesn't make sense for me to like keep rendering those full length articles, because there's not going to be that many people, I think, who want to read that many things in one sitting. So then I started rendering smaller blocks, and then at the end I have links for browsing all the articles, all the podcasts, and all the videos. So I feel like this kind of gradual design where you start with the full-length articles, then you get to like these more blocks that you can click through to go to the full article, and then you have these browse all links at the bottom. I feel like that let me achieve a very nice balance, I feel like, between kind of the different goals that I had for the redesign.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been browsing the website here, and yeah, I really like it. I think it really shows the content in a nice way, and also in a way that's easy to browse. Especially in the articles page, I love what you've done with the filter bar there, which is really useful because it filters basically by what do you have time for now, right?
Right, exactly.
So, I want to just get a little Swift tip. Actually, a feature request, if that's not already there, a random article button would be fun, I think.
Yeah, I really want to do that. I think that would be a super fun feature. I've actually been thinking about that for a long time, but I just haven't gotten around to it, but it could definitely be implemented using something like Cloudflare Workers, right? Mm-hmm. Where I could like query my RSS feed or something, or just like query my search index that I have already, a JSON file with all the articles, and just pick a random element and direct you to that. So that's something that I definitely want to do. Maybe that should be like a little holiday hack for this year.
See, now you found a project.
Right, exactly. I'm not committing to shipping it before New Year's Eve, though. So it's fun that you bring up that filter widget that I have on the article section page now. So that was another one of those like aha moments that I had, where previously the website was organized into these like logical buckets based on what I thought that they are belonging to. So I had like tips, I had Q&A, I had like weekly articles, basics, and so on. Like, these were sections that I was using to organize my work internally, like in my own project. And that was also kind of the structure of the website. But my realization was that users don't really care so much about that differentiation. Like, if I'm writing a tip article, which is like 700 words, and I'm writing a normal article, which is like 800 words, what's the difference between those two, right?
Yeah.
There's no difference. Like, they're both articles. It's just the length that is different. So if I have an article which is like 2,000 words, that's different because it's longer, it's more complex, it goes into more depth. So I realized that the word count is really what matters. And also, like, you know, a little bit about the format. Like you say, if it's purely just one little code snippet and one tip, or if it's actually an article. So that's how I decided to implement those filters instead. So now, instead of having these top level navigation items at the top that says basics or weekly articles and so on, I just have articles. And when you go into that, you see a list of all the articles by default, and then you can filter them based on if you just want a quick read, or if you want a full length article, or just a quick tip or something that is suitable for beginners with basics and so on. So I feel like that's more like a user-centric design rather than like a publisher-centric design, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose you're leveraging the support for custom metadata in Publish for that. Is that how it works?
That's how it works. So nice. I have a publishing step which computes the word count and then saves it in a metadata property. So then when I'm rendering that page, I can just look at that and filter based on that metadata property.
Nice.
So it's pretty nice, I think. And it also lets me compute that once and then store it, because iterating through those strings and computing the word count, like, that's a quite costly operation when you have as many articles as I do. So I want to make sure that I still, you know, it doesn't take too long to re-render the website. So that's why I chose that design.
I just had this really cool idea. You know how the publish pipeline is basically like a graph, right? You can think of it as a graph. So I just had a weird idea to make like a visual editor for your publishing pipeline, so that you can like drag arrows between boxes and create your pipeline that way. That would also be a fun holiday hack.
Yeah, it would. It would be really cool. It really is like that, especially when you start accumulating content and you have many pages on your website. It really is like pretty big data set and like a graph, like you say, which, you know, when you're writing this kind of code, when you're doing this static site generation, it's really about like querying that data and transforming it into HTML. So what you're saying definitely makes sense, like, to treat it that way. In my case, it's less of a graph and more just like a pipeline, right? Like, you go step by step by step, but you could definitely visualize it as a graph as well. I think that would be really interesting. So I also wanted to mention one kind of interesting challenge that I had when I was building this new start page. So I mentioned earlier that as I get to the bottom, I decrease the length of the articles that I show. So I no longer show the full length article, I just show a link to the article. And the reason I also did that, besides kind of the user-facing benefits, was also to keep the HTML that I'm delivering for the start page a little bit more lightweight. So when I first started implementing this and I was rendering all the articles at full length and I was doing like 50 articles or something, the start page started becoming like almost half a megabyte in terms of the HTML size. And, you know, in modern web context, half a megabyte for a website is not that much. I mean, if you go and look in the web inspector for most websites that you visit, they will have a lot of data, you know?
Most websites have way more than that just in tracking scripts.
Exactly. And I don't have any tracking scripts or any scripts at all, really. So the HTML is the major kind of latency factor for me. Of course, I have images and things like that that are also not heavy, but they add up, right, when it comes to the data that's being transferred. But those are asynchronously loaded by the browser. So it's the HTML that is the most important for me, and then the CSS file, which you, of course, load once. And then when you browse the site, it's the same CSS, so you don't have to reload that. That will be cached in the browser. But I realized I wanted to bring that down because I really want my website to feel extremely fast. So even just going to half a megabyte, I feel like would be too much. Even in 2020, 2021, with the internet speeds we have, I don't want to transfer, you know, 500 kilobytes of data. Mm-hmm. So I managed to get it down to around 35 it is right now. And it was by, like, of course, all the compression and things like that that happens server side also helps. But it was also because I started shortening the articles as I went down, and I started reducing the amount of articles I send. I did some optimizations on the HTML itself, and yeah, now I have a really fast website still, even though the start page is much more complicated than what it was before.
Nice.
All right, so busy week for both of us, it seems, and hopefully we'll have some time to relax now over the holidays if we're not both going to jump into those holiday projects that we were just planning. But now, let's talk a little bit about some products that we want to review. We've been reviewing quite a lot of products on Stacktrace during this fall, and it's been a lot of fun, so we want to keep doing that. And Rambo, I know that you have a fun new toy in your possession. What is it that you have?
I got another iPhone.
Of course you did. I feel like maybe, do I need to have an intervention for you about buying new iPhones?
Nah, I'm selling the old ones. So
okay, sure. You have it completely under control. You can stop at any time.
I'm not increasing the number of iPhones. I'm just changing them, basically.
Right, okay. So it's like almost like a queue or a stack.
Yeah, just pop the old one off the stack and then push the new one.
Exactly.
So just to recap, this was my plan from the beginning. The iPhone that I wanted from this year's lineup was the iPhone 12 Pro. But due to lots of things, I was able to get the iPhone Mini first, which is weird because it was released later. But anyway, so for the past like month, probably maybe a little bit more than that, I was using the iPhone 12 mini as my day-to-day device and as my main iPhone, my personal iPhone. But I bought the iPhone 12 mini mostly to be a test device so that I can test my apps in the small screen size. So yesterday I got my iPhone 12 Pro finally, and there isn't that much to review in terms of the device in absolute, because I think that's been reviewed enough already, and I don't really have like, I don't have anything new to say about the camera, for instance. Like, the camera is great. You know that. You've seen all the reviews. I agree. I didn't have any experience with the camera that's different enough to warrant a review of the camera. I do like ProRAW, which is new in 14.3. I'm already running that version here, and I've done a little bit of experimentation with ProRAW, and I like it. It's nice that you can take advantage of that computational photography and at the same time be able to tweak things more than you would with the compressed version. So I do enjoy using ProRAW. In terms of the form factor, so I got the 12 Pro, not the Max, and it's the blue color. What's the name of the color? Do you remember the special name?
It's like navy blue or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Sunset ocean crystal blue.
And if you had the 11 Pro in midnight green, which is the one I had before, it's a similar concept to that, where the color is very subtle. And if you look at it like from the side or from far away, depending on the lighting, it looks like it's a gray iPhone most of the time, but when you actually look at it and depending on the angle, it looks blue. So it's a gray with a little blue tint, and it really looks nice. I love it. I made the right choice in the color, I think. And in terms of holding it, it feels good. It doesn't feel like it's really large. What's changed between the 12 mini and the 12 Pro for me was the weight. Like, there's a huge weight difference. I don't know what the numbers are like, but in terms of just holding it, you really feel the weight of this new device.
And it's one of those things where once you get used to a certain weight, especially if it's a smaller weight and then you go to a more heavy device, the heavier device feels like a brick, right?
Yep.
And I've had this experience with, for example, my laptop and my iPad Pro, and also using the iPad Pro in the smart cover magic keyboard, like the latest one, which is quite heavy, and mm-hmm. then taking it out of that and using it just as a tablet. Yeah. Almost every time I do that, because I tend to use the iPad mostly in that magic keyboard when I'm working on it, but when I use it then, for example, in the kitchen or something, or I just sit on the couch and use it, then I take it out of that case. And that's also what I really love about the iPad, that you can do that. But almost every time I do that, I'm amazed of how light it is. And then if I use it like that for like an hour or something, and then I go back to either my laptop or the iPad in that laptop shape, I just feel like it's like super heavy. It's like it's like I'm holding a brick in my hand. And it's funny because just, you know, a year or two ago or something, I felt like these devices were so light and so lightweight. But it's just, yeah, your brain gets really used to very quickly to weights.
Yeah, definitely. So like picking it up from my pocket feels like work, like in a way that the Mini did not. The Mini, I could just like with my index finger and my thumb, I could just pick it up like it is nothing. But this one, you actually have to really hold it.
Otherwise, the struggle is real, Rambo, picking your iPhone out of your pocket.
Yeah, otherwise you might drop it. Maybe that could be a workout in Fitness Plus, like lifting iPhones.
Sounds like a good product placement opportunity for Apple.
Yeah, and in terms of other differences between the Mini and this one, of course, there's screen size. That's a significant difference, so it's nice that it has a larger screen. There's an aspect of the 12 Mini that's different from all the other phones from this year's lineup, in that the resolution it runs at is scaled a little bit. I don't know the numbers, but it is scaled. It's not like one-to-one pixel to points thing that where you can really notice the crispness of the screen, and especially with typography and things like that. I mean, if you get the iPhone 12 mini, you're not going to notice it. But when you look at them side by side, and when you've been using the 12 mini and you switch to the 12 Pro, it would be the same with the 12 as well. It doesn't have to be the Pro. You notice the difference. Like, it is a noticeable difference, but nothing that I would take into account when deciding which device to get. And another thing, I'm pretty sure the 12 Pro has a little bit more RAM. I think maybe the Mini has 4 gigs and this one has 6 or something like that. And I don't know if it's placebo, just that I've just set up this device and it's new and shiny and doesn't have a bunch of stuff making it slow, but it feels a little bit more snappy to me. Like using Spotlight and things like that feels a little bit faster to me, but I wouldn't say that's a significant difference as well. But I do notice that apps tend to stay in the background for longer in the 12 Pro, so that additional RAM definitely helps.
Yeah, especially on a platform like iOS, where the system will kill off apps in the background, like remove them from memory very aggressively as you move between apps. And that, as everyone knows who's used an iPhone since ever knows, can be a little bit frustrating sometimes, right? Where yeah, you're like right in the middle of something on an app, you want to go to another app to check something, you come back and that app has reloaded in the background. And you're like, oh no, my state is all gone now. And having more RAM, of course, helps in that sense. And like you say, it can also be the placebo effect of having something new, and you kind of feel like it feels fresh and it feels faster. And because I believe that these CPUs are almost identical. Like if you look at the Geekbench score, I think there's like one difference of one in terms of the Geekbench score, in terms of like 1,584 versus 85 or something between the iPhone 12 and the 12 Pro.
Yeah, I can think of like two little things that could make a slight difference. Maybe the scaling itself has a bit of an impact on GPU on the 12 mini. Because like on your Mac, I don't think in the M1 it does that, but in previous Macs, if you change the default resolution to a scaled one, it will like warn you that that could impact performance. So I don't know if it's a thing on the iPhone or not. And also like for my Spotlight example, maybe when you have this additional RAM and you've been using lots of apps and then you go to use Spotlight, it's already warmed up. In a way, it wouldn't be on the 12 mini because it had to purge the memory that was being used. So it has to like reload things more often than this one. And this is a thing on the iPhone, like you mentioned, because the system will purge memory very aggressively. And that's because there's no swap on iOS. So iOS doesn't swap to disk, basically.
And that's also why on the M1-based machines, you know, which run macOS, which does support swap, you don't have that much problem with RAM in general. Like, yeah, if you would have an iOS device with the same amount of RAM as a Mac, those two wouldn't be equivalent. So even if you have an M1 Mac with 8 gigabytes of RAM, like you do, Rambo, which is not that much more than 6 gigabytes, it still makes a huge difference just because macOS supports swap.
Yeah, definitely. So I think that's basically what I wanted to say about the iPhone 12 Pro. Everything else, like I agree with most of the reviews, like the cameras are great, the screen is great, the form factor, I love it. I think it looks beautiful. I don't have 5G here to test, but 5G is a thing and it seems to work for people who have it in their area. Even though there are some differences that make me like the 12 Pro better than the 12 Mini, I would say it's safe to recommend the 12 Mini if you want a small phone. I think because if you look at the difference in size and especially in weight, it is a very significant difference. So if you're looking for a small, light phone, you're definitely going to be very happy with the 12 Mini.
Awesome. You know what's interesting is that back when, you know, a few years ago, when new phones would come out, we would always think about how that would impact us as developers. Like a new form factor, a new screen size would always be like pretty big thing for most developers. You would need to go back and retest your app on it and make some tweaks and things like that. And I'm not just talking about the era when we went from like when there was one iPhone screen size and then there were multiple ones and then you had to remove all those hard-coded 320 by 480. But later, like even when the iPhone like 10 came out, for example, there was a lot of changes that developers needed to make in order to support like the safe area insets and the notch and things like that. But for the last few years, I feel like it's been almost like a non-event for these phones to come out from a developer's perspective. I don't, as an iOS developer myself, feel the need to like own every single iPhone and test on every single iPhone, because I feel like if I just make my layout adaptive and I follow all the system frameworks for safe area insets and an auto layout or in Swift UI, where a lot of this is taken care of for you, it's just going to work. And I feel like that's really nice, actually, and something I really appreciate, that it's now reached a level of maturity in the iPhone ecosystem. And us as developers and as a community, we've kind of realized that we have a much wider range of devices and screen sizes to target, so we write our code accordingly. So I feel like it's typically not so much anymore that you have to really think about each particular individual device. Or what do you think, Rambo?
Yeah, I agree. I think also the mindset of the developers has changed, because in the past, it was easy to just, even when there were a couple of different sizes and iPhone versus iPads, you could hard code like for 3 devices, maybe 4. But right now there are so many that it's not practical to hard code anything. And people tend to use Apple solution, auto layouts and layout guides and size classes. And like you mentioned, Swift UI takes care of most of this stuff for you. So I think most apps are already made in a way where resizing them is not a big deal. And these new screen sizes, they are just basically resizing what's already there. So yeah, it tends to work. You can also see it when running iOS apps on the Mac, when they're iPad apps and you resize them and they just work. Basically, it doesn't like completely break the layout of the app.
Yeah, and now, of course, we're talking about layout specifically. So if you're using some new hardware capabilities in the new phones, then that's, of course, different. If you wanted to build like a LiDAR-based app or something, right? Or, you know, a camera-based app, which has to use all the latest camera features, that's also very different. But in terms of layout, it's pretty much like a quote-unquote solved problem, right? Like, you know how to deal with it, basically. And that's just really, really nice. And, of course, it also helps that things like the iPhone 12 mini uses the same kind of screen size as the iPhone 10 series of devices, but just then downsamples that into a smaller physical screen size. Mm-hmm. So that also helps in terms of development, because you don't really have to worry about it as a developer. It's the same amount of points, but they just get rendered differently.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. So that's the iPhone 12 Pro review from you, Rambo. And I know that you also have another Apple-related product. I guess it's technically an Apple product, but an Apple child product, maybe, because it's owned by a subsidiary of Apple?
Yeah, so I got the Beats Flex. So you can expect me to have every single headset that Apple or Beats make, because I make everybody, and that's a great excuse to buy every single headset released by Apple or Beats.
right.
But it actually makes a difference that I actually have the hardware, because even though I can support things, like yesterday's release of AirBuddy supports the AirPods Max, but that's the like initial it works support. But when I actually get the hardware, I can find out through my own use things that I can make even better and test things and see how I can make the experience even better. So it is good that I actually have the hardware. And the Beats Flex was released a while ago without much in the way of announcement. I think they seeded a few review units for the press. I think Zach from 9to5 got them. And they basically replaced the Beats X. So they are this in-ear earbuds, and they are joined by a cable. So they're not true, complete wireless like the AirPods. And I think one thing that's really good about these is the price. So these are priced at $49.99. So they're pretty inexpensive if you consider that these get you into the Apple headset ecosystem, and they have the niceties of AirPods-like products, like the easy pairing and auto switching between devices, and they work with AirBuddy, of course, which is the main reason why people would buy them, of course. So they are really good, and in terms of sound quality, they sound great. They sound like a Beats product. They are a little bit heavy on the bass, which is pretty common with Beats headphones or earbuds, and I know that a lot of people like that. Some people don't. So if you don't like that particular profile, then these might not be for you. They have a few controls on the cable. You can increase and decrease volume, and they have an on-off button. They have a cool thing where they don't have the in-ear detection like AirPods, but the backside of the buds is magnetic, so you can attach one to the other. And this is really good when you're not using them to keep them around your neck like a necklace, like a headset necklace. and when you do that, they will pause anything that's playing. So it's kind of like... also, fun fact here, it's not a deep dive, but the way they communicate that to the system that's connected to them is that when they are stuck together, they are off-ear, and when they're stuck together, when they are separated, they are in-ear. That's how they talk to the system. So it's basically like putting them in your ear or removing them from your ear, like the AirPods. So that's a little cool little thing. And another thing that's really nice about them is that they come with different pairs of ear tips. So you get the small, medium, large, and another one that has like a different format, which I don't really know how to explain it in a podcast, but it's basically double. Like there's a small tip and then a larger tip behind it, like a pyramid of sorts. So depending on your ear shape or your preference, I guess you can exchange the ear tips and use the one that fits you the most. The biggest problem I've had with them was actually finding the right tip for me, because since they don't have active noise cancellation, you need to find the perfect fit, basically, so that they will stay in your ear and seal the earbuds in your ear so that you get the full sound. Otherwise, they sound kind of like you basically lose all the low ends of the sound, and it sounds pretty awful. So you have to make sure that you get the right fit. But yeah, I can definitely recommend them if you're looking for something that will get you into the Apple W1 headset ecosystem and you don't want to spend a lot of money, these are great.
I guess also a trade-off, at least that for me would almost be like a deal breaker compared to the AirPods, is that you have that thing around your neck. I feel like, you know, with the AirPods, you can just put them in your ears and they're so lightweight and they're barely visible. And that I feel like it's such a much better design than what the Beats have.
Yeah, absolutely. But of course, that's a compromise they will have to take for the price, right? I think that can also be an advantage depending on the context. So if you're looking for a headset to use while like running or doing some sort of sporting or some sort of workout, I think the wire can actually be a good thing, because to take them out of your ears, you just take them out and leave them hanging around your neck. And it's pretty easy to attach them magnetically, like I mentioned. While with AirPods, you have to take them out a little bit more carefully and put them in the charging case. It's a trade-off. Depends on what you're looking for. But I think the price is what sells these. I think they're a great value for the $50 price.
Yeah, it's funny that you can buy 11 one of these instead of AirPods Max.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, there's definitely a huge range now in terms of price of these products. If you, again, count these as Apple products, like from $49 all the way up to the $550.
Yeah, definitely. And I've actually been thinking about making like a guide, maybe something for like the AirBuddy support website or something. Because I do have experience with pretty much all of them, except for the AirPods Max, but I will eventually. So I do plan on maybe like making a guide to Apple's and Beats headsets.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. I guess like for people who are really tuned into this topic and, you know, keep track of all the headsets that Apple come out with, you kind of know which one to get or what's the difference. But if you're just casually like browsing for headsets to buy, then that can be pretty difficult. And yeah. I had this experience myself, not with Apple headsets, but with headsets in general, because I wanted to get a really nice pair of gaming headphones, like for playing games. And there's so many different options out there. And I ended up like watching so many different reviews and comparisons and things like that. And I ended up getting the SteelSeries Arctis 7X, which I think I mentioned on a previous episode. And it's been really nice to have these new headphones. And I also have like a Dolby Atmos plugin for the new Xbox. Mm. So I get like Dolby Atmos, like simulated surround sound in the headphones. And that's been such a huge upgrade in terms of playing games. Like in the evening, for example, when I play with headphones as to not disturb everyone around me, it's super nice because you get that really nice, strong cinematic sound, even when you're wearing headphones. Before, I was kind of plugging in the old Apple earbuds, the one you used to get with the iPhone, the one with the headphone jack. Yeah. I plugged those like directly into the controller. And this is definitely like a huge upgrade over that, because not only do I have Dolby Atmos support, but these headphones also connect directly to the Xbox using a kind of proprietary connection. So they have like really, really low latency, and you plug a dongle into the console. And then you can also use that dongle with like different devices as well. So it's been really, really nice. I think having a great pair of headphones, whether it's for working or for gaming or for working out or whatever it is, like it's such a huge, nice upgrade.
Nice. Yeah, I was wondering how they would achieve an acceptable latency for gaming. And I guess it's all in that custom hardware that they've built.
Yeah, there's also like for Xbox specifically, there's like a wireless protocol that third parties can also implement that is the same protocol that the controller itself uses. And that's, of course, like an acceptable level of latency because you're controlling the game using that protocol.
Yeah.
But I've heard that that's a little bit more flaky for sound specifically. Again, I haven't tried it myself. I just watched a lot of reviews about it. So that's why I ended up buying these ones, because they had that like really solid connection. And it's really been rock solid. Like you just turn them on, the console detects them. You can just start playing immediately. It's really, really nice. It's super low latency. Like I really can't tell that there's any latency. And I'm also using them wired sometimes with a Mac, and you can also plug it into the Switch. So there's like, it's pretty nice, like all around the headphones. They don't have Bluetooth though, so that's like a trade-off. But in terms of gaming, I don't want to use Bluetooth anyway. So
yeah,
that's a fine trade-off for me in this case.
Yeah, sounds good.
So lots of headphones today and lots of reviews. That's always fun for us to talk about our experience using these products as well. But now let's move back into like code and Apple tech land. And let's talk about Ask Stacktrace and let's answer some questions from our audience. So we have a question here from Derek this week. And Derek has a little bit longer question that I'm going to read here. I'm actually even making it shorter because it came through email. And that's always a challenge when you get questions over email is that with Twitter, there's this natural like cap at 240 characters, right?
Yeah.
But with email, like it's kind of hard to read a whole email out on a podcast, but I'm going to do my best here. So Derek says that he has an iOS app that has some native iOS code to generate SVGs and PDF files. And he's porting it to macOS using Catalyst and would also like to experiment making a web version using server-side Swift. And as a shortcut to that experiment and to create like the front-end experience, he's considering to execute this existing macOS and iOS core graphics-based code on a server that's running macOS and then expose that as a REST API endpoint. So he has a question where he says, I believe that a while ago, you, Rambo, you mentioned that you are using macOS servers for this particular purpose to render assets on the back end, and he would like you to talk a little bit more about that and how that can be achieved. So Rambo, can you tell us a little bit more about your macOS setup and how you execute like Apple specific server side code on Mac hardware in the cloud?
Yeah, I believe what he's referring to here is the Splash experiment that we had, right, where I would run Splash on a Mac Mini on Mac Stadium, and it would use core graphics with, I think, the attributed string output to generate a PNG file, and that was running on Mac OS. So there are lots of ways to go about this. In this case, he mentioned he's porting it to Mac OS using Catalyst. It's interesting that from what he's referring to here, SVGs and PDFs, I don't see why any of that would be iOS specific, right? Because that's quite low level and core graphics is portable. So it works the same between, I mean, not the exact same, but it works similarly enough between iOS and the Mac. But even with a Catalyst version, there are definitely ways he could go about doing this. So let me talk about the simple version first, and then we can explore some options. So the simple way to do it would be to have this rendering code, whatever it is, if it handles SVGs or PDFs, in a portable like a library. Preferably, it would be a static library, and then you would create a command line app target in your Xcode project, basically. And you would link this static library into your command line tool. And you'd use this command line tool when you are doing the REST API call. So you don't have to like implement a web server in Cocoa or something. Like you can put your core graphics code in a little command line tool that you build from within Xcode. And you can make your REST endpoint using anything. Like you can use Node.js, you can use something like Vapor or whatever, and then just call into this command line tool of yours. And of course, be careful to sanitize inputs to prevent remote code execution and things like that. But it can be done. It can be done like that. So you basically completely decouple the core graphics code from your backend, but it's also a front end. Like it's the backend to a front end that runs on the web, but it's the front end to the other backend. That's this command line tool,
right?
It's a lot of front end and then backend stuff here. But another way to do it would be to say you're doing this in Swift and you're using something like Vapor. You could actually link this static library that I mentioned that you've built, or just like copy your files over if you wanted to, and actually build the rendering code into your Swift on the server app or your Swift on the server project. That's perfectly possible. The only limitation, of course, is that your server codes would only work on the Mac because the Mac has core graphics and Cocoa and whatever else you're using. So that's how I would do it probably. I think it's a little bit of a more clean approach, but if you want to decouple your Swift on the server project from the actual rendering codes, you can also do it in the other way, which is to create a separate command line tool.
You could also do something where, let's say you wanted to kind of scale this up and run it at a larger scale, you could have separate servers as well for these separate tasks. So you could have your quote-unquote normal REST API, like your database and things like that, running on a separate server, and that could be more portable, so it could run both on Linux and macOS and any other hardware you wanted. And then you have a specific API only for this rendering code that is Mac-specific that you would deploy on something like Mac Stadium, which we should disclose is a frequent sponsor of the show, but, you know, we use them, so that's why we're mentioning them here. Not a sponsorship this time. But it's a very good way to run a Mac in the cloud. But you could also set up your own server and things like that, of course. But you probably want something a little bit more managed if you want to run it in production. I think splitting it up that way makes a lot of sense, because you might not want to run your entire backend infrastructure only specifically on macOS, especially if you want to grow that and scale that. That could become a little bit expensive and kind of narrow you down in terms of options. But if you need something Mac specific for one particular task, you could just have that as a separate server.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that would be a great approach if this is something that you think will scale up a lot. So yeah, it's definitely an option. And if you actually want to be able to use your Catalyst part, let's say this rendering code had there's something about it that you can't just link your code into a command line tool on the Mac or like a Swift on the server thing. You have to run it through your Catalyst app. There are ways to do that. You could set up an XPC service in your Catalyst app and then have a separate command line tool that over XPC sends rendering requests to this Catalyst version. This is definitely not something that Apple supports officially, but as of Catalina and up, Catalyst apps, they are native Mac apps and they have a NapKit app behind them. So through some shenanigans, you can do that. Absolutely. It will be a bit weird and hacky in a sense, but it's definitely something that could work as well if the only way you can get your code to run is through Catalyst. Because, of course, there's no way, at least none that I know of, to make a command line tool that runs on Catalyst land.
And doing something like that would be pretty complicated because you're dealing with so many different tech stacks at that point anyway. Yeah. Another option that I also wanted to bring up here, which I think is really worth considering, is to actually not make this like Swift or Apple platform specific, but to utilize something a little bit more cross-platform. So it could be, you know, it depends on what kind of rendering we're talking about here, but it's likely that there exists some kind of libraries or some way to do this kind of rendering in a language like JavaScript or C++ or Ruby or anything else that you could more easily port. Of course, also it could be in Swift, but not using core graphics. So that's if you're looking for something to be more portable and something you could more easily deploy on any kind of server, not just the Mac, then that's a route I would also explore because it would just give you more flexibility. But yeah, there are many options here, of course, and it all depends on like what trade-offs are you willing to accept. If this is indeed like a prototype and you just want to get started, then doing something like some of the earlier suggestions we had where you are like decoupling this rendering code into like a command line tool and running that on a Mac mini in the cloud or something, that would probably be a great idea just to kind of validate the idea.
Yeah, and this is not like super weird or anything. I don't know the technical details about it, but I know that like Sketch does this for their cloud collaboration solution. So they basically have Macs in the cloud running Sketch or something that has Sketch code in there, and they can render their stuff. And in that case, like, and I don't know if this is Derek's case or not, but like, let's say I want to have a web version of Chibi Studio. Everything in there is core animation, and there's no core animation for Linux, unfortunately. So I would have to resort to something like this. And also, I think the Omni Group for their apps, they also do something like this. So it's not unprecedented that a Mac app that wants to have like a web presence and wants to use its engine for the web as well will do that and actually run the app in the cloud and send the results over a REST endpoint.
Yeah, because really what you have to weigh here is like the complexities between all these different solutions and, you know, what you think you could maintain the easiest and all those kind of costs. You have to like balance them. So if you take something like a really complex app, like Chibi Studio is a fairly complex app that you've built, and building like a something brand new from the ground up again that has the exact same behavior, doing that yourself would probably be pretty difficult. So for you, like exploring that route of like doing like server-side rendering using like a Mac app that outputs through a web server, that could actually be worth it for you, because then you only have one code base to maintain. Sure, that actual part where you're rendering and outputting to a web server might not be as straightforward as running like a standard Linux server, right?
Yeah.
But that might be worth it for you because you have that really large technical complexity that you don't want to have to maintain two separate versions of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So like always, the answer is it depends. But at least we explained what it depends on. That's the most important, right? If you just say it depends, it's not very interesting. But if you say it depends on X, Y, and Z, then all of a sudden it's pretty interesting.
Definitely.
Cool. So thanks a lot for that question. And just to remind everybody, you can ask us questions either via Twitter. So you can tweet with the hashtag AskStackTrace, or you can send us an email on the address stacktrace@9to5mac.com. Either way works fine. But keep in mind, we are going to read these questions on a podcast. So if you can try to keep them a little bit short, we would really appreciate it. But regardless, we really appreciate your questions. It's so much fun to hear from people listening to the show. And we also love hearing your reviews. So if you want to post a review on Apple Podcasts, for example, telling us what you think about our show, we love reading that as well. Or just tweet at us on Twitter any feedback or something that you have. It's really great to hear that too. But regardless, thanks so much for listening, everybody. And we'll talk to you again next week. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye. Where you can really notice the Christmas. Where you can really notice the crispiness of it's crispness.
Jingle bells.